Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
It's Tuesday, March the 5th, and your Ben Jarofsky Show starts now. Today on the show, Ben is back from the weekend. He is talking top stories. He's talking the Supreme Court. He's talking elections. He's talking the ballot. Who better to talk with him than attorney Karen Lederer? The Ben Jarofsky Show, a presentation of the Chicago Reader. ChicagoReader.com for everything there is to know in the city of Chicago. You want to know what to do? Where to go? What to eat? You want to know what to drink? In the city of Chicago, after a long week, you get to Friday and you're like, where do I want to go? You need to hit the ChicagoReader.com. Everything you want to know right there. And if you want more Ben Jarofsky, head to ChicagoReader.com/Jarofsky. That's J-O-R-A-V as in victory, S-K-Y.
Hello again, everybody. Ben Jarofsky here. We're calling this Look Out Taxpayers Tuesday, and here's why. I got Karen Lederer sitting on hold. We're going to take the deep dive on the Supreme Court ruling that went down yesterday on Trump and Colorado and the impact it has in Illinois. But before we do that, ladies and gentlemen, I just got to say one thing. I saw the front page of today's Chicago Sun-Times. Yeah, I actually read the newspaper. Double play. This is so funny. It's like, this is like a bad sketch at Second City that is playing out, unfolding it right in front of us. So the developer got a hold of the Chicago Sun-Times reporter and fed her an exclusive that says, developer says White Sox and Bears are discussing financing partnership that could bring two new stadiums to the city. Okay, just so you know, ladies and gentlemen, I know you're really smart out there in Ben Jarofsky listening land. Financing partnerships means figuring out a way to get the taxpayers to pay for not one, but two stadiums. Not one, but two. We didn't even know we were on the hook for the White Sox new stadium until about a month or so ago when they fed the story to the Sun-Times that they wanted to build a stadium. In fact, I thought we weren't going to be on the hook for either stadium because I thought the Bears are going to go to Arlington Heights. Now, apparently that's not going well. So they got to figure out a way to get the taxpayers to pay for two stadiums that the taxpayers didn't even know they were going to be building like 2 months ago. And part of the reason why they're in this pickle is that the White Sox, as I've said many times, cut the Bears off at the knees because the Bears need hotel motel tax to build their little stadium on the lake. But the White Sox got there first and proposed for the hotel motel tax to go to them. And now the White Sox are like, uh-oh, the Bears are mad at the White Sox. This is like a behind-the-scenes little squabble. The Bears are probably saying, why are you taking our hotel motel tax? And the White Sox are going, no. We'll figure out a way for both of us to soak the saps in this city. Oh, my God. That story just gets my blood boiling. All right. I will now move to another story that gets my blood boiling, and that is the decision by the Supreme Court of the United States of America to allow Donald Trump to remain on the presidential ballot in states like Colorado and Illinois and Maine. Even though it's pretty obvious to anybody who has studied anything to do with January 6th that he was a participant in an insurrection against our country. And it says in the 14th Amendment, as clear as day, that that would disqualify him. Without further ado, I'm going to bring on a distinguished attorney, Karen Lederer, who is one of the leaders of the case, one of the lawyers and leaders in the case to have Trump removed from the ballot here in Illinois, a case which got thrown out the window yesterday with the Supreme's ruling. First of all, Karen, thanks for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me, Ben.
All right, let's get down to the nitty gritty here. So I thought you had him. I really did. And I've been writing ballot access stories about the city of Chicago, the state of Illinois, for years and years, Karen. And ballot access means there's rules and regulations that govern a candidate's ability to be on the ballot. You break the rules, you break the regulations, you're off the ballot. It's that simple. It's like, as I always say, playing tennis. You got a net. If the ball hits the net, you don't get the point. If the ball goes outside the line, you don't get the point. It's that simple, ladies and gentlemen. I thought the Supremes were supposed to be, how do they say it? Umpires calling balls and strikes and whether the ball is out of the net. Well, now it seems like they invented an entire new rule, Karen, to justify keeping Donald Trump on the ballot. That's my big picture interpretation. We'll get to the specifics as we continue the conversation. Is there anything I said that you vehemently disagree with and must point out that I'm wrong? Go.
I do not vehemently disagree with you on any point. I think you're exactly right in terms of ballot access being defined by rules. And, you know, what we have seen time and time again is that in the state of Illinois, as in many states, the constitutional rules for who can be president are upheld. You know, there are rules about age. There are rules about not serving more than two terms. There are rules about being a natural born citizen. And there has been, up until yesterday, a rule that has not come up very much in the history of our country, because there has not been a lot of insurrection in the history of our country, that if you take an oath to support the Constitution and engage in insurrection, you cannot again hold office. That was a rule that was governing the presidency. The Supreme Court yesterday said that's not a rule that states can enforce.
All right. So let's start at the top then. So, well, states can't enforce it. So the rule says clearly that if you participated in an insurrection then against the country and the office that you swore to uphold, you cannot run again. That rule says that. So then the first thing you have to establish before you can judge whether the president has violated the rule is, did he violate the rule? And the Supreme Court did not even address the issue of whether Donald John Trump was an insurrectionist. So this is my question for you. How can they make a decision on a case of such importance without evaluating this key issue of whether or not Donald John Trump is an insurrectionist?
That's a great question, Ben. And it goes to the issue of, you know, kind of which comes first, the chicken or the egg. And so the way the Supreme Court approached this is looking at it and saying, can you implement this rule? Can you apply this rule? And what the majority of the justices, what all nine of the justices said was, no, the states can't apply this rule. So essentially, this is the unsaid part of the decision. Even if Donald Trump engaged in insurrection, we don't need to get there because the rule doesn't apply in this challenge, this Colorado state ballot access challenge. Now, could they have delved in to the part of the Colorado Supreme Court decision that very explicitly and in great detail evaluated whether or not Donald Trump engaged in insurrection and held that he did? They absolutely could have, and they chose not to. And so part of what that means is that the Colorado Supreme Court's decision, finding, again, in great detail, that Donald Trump engaged in insurrection, nothing disturbs that. That is still an important decision and one that folks can look at. And if they want to know what a reasoned court of judges determined about January 6th, they can look at that decision and say, This court evaluated evidence and found that Donald J. Trump engaged in insurrection. And the same is true for the decision here in Illinois that our legal team secured from Judge Tracy Porter. She evaluated a very robust body of evidence and said Donald Trump engaged in insurrection. His role in January 6th is insurrection.
All right. So I know this, I can almost hear your opening response, because anything you say in response to this question is speculative. But why did they choose not to engage like the most paramount piece of this matter? Like there were crime was committed, an alleged crime was committed. One jurisdiction said it was a crime. They don't even engage in that issue, which to me is the most fundamentally important issue. Are we going to allow an insurrectionist to be our next president, even though it violates the Constitution? They don't even engage. So in your opinion, why did they avoid that essential issue?
I think there's a number of answers to that question, and it probably depends quite a lot on which justice you're focusing on. You know, there are certainly some justices, if we look at Amy Coney Barrett's concurrence, she highlighted that she thought unity was incredibly important. This is probably the most divisive of all of the issues that Donald Trump presented to the court. He wanted a decision that said he did not engage in insurrection. I feel pretty confident in saying there are some justices that did not want to make that decision and do not agree that he did not engage in insurrection. I'm quite certain there are also justices that would be quite happy to decide that Donald Trump did not engage in insurrection and make that part of the decision. But, you know, if you look at the concurrences that are written as a whole, they do make the point that, generally speaking, it is often a principle of the court's decisions that they address what is necessary to resolve the case. And there was agreement from the nine justices that the states didn't have the authority to resolve a ballot challenge in this way. And so that's where they stopped. But, you know, it is, again, also very true that there was a decision not to disturb the Colorado Supreme Court's decision that Donald Trump engaged in insurrection. That was something Donald Trump asked the court to resolve, and it left that alone.
So, all right, well, let's get into the issue with the state's jurisdiction then, which I found amusing as, again, a longtime observer of how the game is played in the state of Illinois and the city of Chicago. Ballot access, again, this is a ballot access question. So I recall, this is probably before your time, Karen, that when a third party candidate, I'm thinking Ralph Nader, wanted to run a third party campaign in Illinois, the Democratic Party, they unleashed this guy named Michael Casper, an election lawyer. He worked for Michael Joseph Madigan, who used to be the House Speaker, and they went after every signature. And that, I mean, Karen, they like, Casper's no joke on these signature challenges, okay? Every signature. Well, the signature that you have here on this document doesn't match the signature that we have on our microfilm file. And then I'm not making this up, Karen. They drag people in the court with affidavits. Did you sign this petition? And they do everything they can to knock off signatures. I never once heard anybody, Amy Coney Barrett, I never heard Neil Gorsuch. I never heard Clarence Thomas. I never heard Sam Alito ever say anything remotely like, I'm sorry, Illinois, you cannot do that to Ralph Nader because you as a state don't have the right to determine who gets to be on the ballot. I mean, it would be so chaotic and confusing if you, the state of Illinois, with Michael Casper and Michael Joseph Madigan, could kick Ralph Nader off the ballot. Oh, my God, what the impact it's going to have on Michigan and Colorado. My little Supreme Court justice brain is blowing up. Never once heard it, Karen. It's like something they just invented right now. I'm just telling you right now. Nine, liberals, you were part of it, just invented something that didn't exist. Am I right or am I wrong? Go.
I mean, for listeners who can't see me laughing very hard as you're talking, Ben, you know, look, we took the position in the arguments that we made first to the Electoral Board and then in court, that there's a long history grounded in Article 2 of the Constitution of states enforcing ballot access questions. And what we've seen happen in Illinois and has, you know, happened in countless other states is when candidates don't meet qualifications, either because of something that you're talking about quite specific, like signatures, or because, for example, they don't meet the age requirement. States have been empowered to control ballot access. There's a case from the 70s that deals with a presidential candidate from the Socialist Workers Party who was not 35 years old. And a federal court upheld the electoral board's decision to keep her off the ballot because she didn't meet the constitutionally mandated age requirement. All that is to say, you know, there has been a long history of states enforcing ballot access questions, even for the presidency.
Yeah, and right here in the state of Illinois. So they just chose to ignore it. They chose to ignore this long history that exists.
I think that what they did more specifically, Ben, was they said Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is different than all those other types of requirements. And, you know, what you see in the concurrence by the three justices is they in a not so veiled way essentially say, we think that by going as far as they did, the majority is really making this decision to encompass Donald Trump and other people who participated in January 6th. So, you know, I do think that it's accurate that the court as a whole believes that there should not be differences among the states. I mean, our view in looking at this issue, as we argued it many, many times and through very detailed legal briefs that killed many, many trees, is, you know, the Supreme Court's function is to resolve issues that start in a particular state and make their way up to the Supreme Court. So the fact that there's a ballot challenge to a presidential candidate that starts in Colorado or Illinois, you know, ultimately, if it's poorly supported, the Supreme Court would knock it down the same way that they have the function of doing with all sorts of other legal issues that invariably start in one state or another and are governed by the governing law in that state or in that federal jurisdiction. But here, the nine justices agreed that's not how it should work for the presidency.
Wow. It's mind-boggling. I actually think that point you made at the outset was really on target. This was designed to protect Donald Trump. I'm going to throw this one at you and get your response. We've talked a lot about on the show for months about how intimidating MAGA could be as a force. Donald Trump is the leader of this. Donald Trump goes after judges. He goes after judicial clerks. He goes the potential jurors, grand jurors. Fani Willis in Georgia, the prosecuting defender, prosecutor, who's trying to try Trump for his role in the insurrection, trying to steal an election allegedly, has been the subject of many threats. And the judge and the prosecutors and all the other cases against Trump have been the subject of many threats. I believe that the Supreme Court justices are acknowledging that they're intimidated by MAGA. They're intimidated by Donald Trump. They don't want to bear the consequences of the threats, the potential violence, if they kick him off the ballot. And I feel this is mob rule. This is what we're seeing here. That's my opinion. Your thoughts?
I don't know if I agree with that exactly, but I do think that the Supreme Court has a view, and of course this is pure speculation, you know, that knocking Trump off the ballot is problematic and has an anti-democratic effect. I mean, that's something that I strongly disagree with. I think a lot of folks who believe in rule of law and the Constitution and making sure that constitutional principles are upheld disagree with. But I think that there's, you know, the noise of the case and the concern about maybe not what will happen to them personally, but what the impact in the country will be does have an impact.
All right. So let me ask you a question that it may take an expert to answer. I'm trying to figure out. Okay, so it was a 9-0 vote, which meant all nine judges participated, including Clarence Thomas. I'm trying to figure out And you got to help me with this one, Karen. How Clarence Thomas gets to participate in this vote, even though his wife is one of the leaders in the effort by Trump to have Congress reverse the will of the voters. So she, you could argue that Clarence Thomas's wife was, if not a participant in the alleged insurrection, was a supporter of the insurrection. There's plenty of proof of that. I mean, I guess I'm used to the great standards of reform that exist here in Illinois. And you're smiling because Illinois is known as a corrupt state. But yet in Illinois, I saw Supreme Court Judge Ann Burke not participate in many votes that had anything related to her husband, who was former alderman Ed Burke. Why do we have higher standards of reform and unbiased judges in Illinois than they do at the Supreme Court?
Yeah, I mean, another great question. There were a lot of folks calling for Clarence Thomas to recuse himself from this deliberation for the very reason that you outlined. And I think one thing that, you know, when we look at the federal court system and particularly the Supreme Court, there are some of these procedures that are less defined, less developed. We see that either there's been a movement to expand a lot of rules and protocols governing the conduct of judges in the federal judiciary in the past few years, I think particularly in the aftermath of the Kavanaugh hearings. And it's a slow process.
Yeah, it is a slow process. I think it's a frozen process in regards to Clarence Thomas. All right. So I don't think I'll ever win on the Clarence Thomas issue until Clarence Thomas leaves the court eventually. I don't think he'll ever recuse himself on anything. And since there doesn't seem to be anybody to force him to, he's just going to get away with it. So we do have higher standards here in Illinois. All right. So this one has left me confused, and I'm really going to need your help on this one. So if the Supremes are saying that Colorado or Illinois can't determine the ballot access in the case of an insurrectionist, then how do you do it going forward? What is their guide, their solution for the, let's say we have another insurrectionist who wants to be president. And if we want to really, once finally enforce this rule that says insurrectionists can't run for president, what are the steps that must be taken if they're now determining Colorado can't do it, or Illinois can't do it, or Maine can't do it, et cetera? Go ahead.
Right. So, and one point of clarification, you know, the court's decision is limited to federal candidates. So they say the states can enforce Section 3 of the 14th Amendment with regard to state candidates. But, you know, what the majority decision says is that you need congressional legislation in order to enforce Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. And this is a point of conflict between the majority decision and the concurrence. The concurrence basically says, hey, we don't agree that we need to spell out exactly what you need to do to kick someone off the ballot, to remove someone from office because of insurrection under Section 3. You went too far, majority, by saying it has to be through congressional legislation. The concurrence very specifically said all of these legal arguments that special legislation is needed, that Section 3 of the 14th Amendment isn't what we call self-executing, those are bunk. And, you know, you should have just said that the states can't enforce it. But, you know, the majority decision was both vague and specific. They were specific in saying that congressional legislation was needed, but somewhat vague in saying exactly how it would work.
Absolutely. I mean, it's both vague and specific. So I have no idea. Like, if I were going to explain this to a 10-year-old, so these are the rules that you have to abide by going forward. I don't know what rule. I don't even know what congressional legislation means. What does that mean, congressional legislation?
Like, they'll have to pass a law that would spell out the procedures for doing it. And I think this is a really important point if you're someone who likes to get in the weeds about this. And this is another point that concurrence makes. You know, what Section 3 of the 14th Amendment says is that if you are an oath-breaking insurrectionist, you can be cleared of that disability by a supermajority of Congress. But in making the decision that legislation is needed to even start, even use Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, what the majority is saying is you don't need that supermajority. You just need enough congressional votes to pass a bill that's going to put it in effect. So it's very contradictory.
Absolutely. And then what I don't understand is, do you need just general rules governing every single instance where this constitutional stipulation is the reason given for barring someone from being the presidential candidate? Or do you have to pass a law specifying that one individual? Do you follow the distinction there? It's one between a general rule and a very specific rule.
Yeah, I mean, I don't take the decision to mean that legislation is needed for a specific person. But, you know, this is one of the problems that the concurrence pointed out, that when you make a bunch of rules in the abstract, particularly like by a court that's now setting up a procedure, it's a little bit hard to know how it's going to play out in the future and what circumstances are going to be important for actually figuring out the rules. Usually, you know, it's not the courts react to rules that have already been developed by Congress and interpret what they mean, as opposed to setting up the procedures in the first place.
Wow, man, that is so true. That is so true what you just said. If the rule that you make, if the decision you make is vague and specific, and you establish a rule without specifying what the rules are, it's like a Kafka-esque world that you live in, where nothing is real.
I think a lot of us have been feeling like the world operates that way recently.
There are rules, but there are no rules. And then they also threw this line in. Of course, we reserve the right to judge whether the law that Congress passes is constitutional or not. Remember, they threw that in there, that little stipulation. They threw that in there just to say, hey, we still exist, even as we give Donald Trump permission. Wow. It's a pretty remarkable ruling. It allows Trump to remain on the ballot in Colorado and Illinois. There was a quote by you in the newspaper. I think it was the Sun-Times story I read. I can't remember. I've read so many stories, Karen. That said, the case is not over in Illinois. So what exactly did you mean by that in that quote?
Well, there's a couple things. I'm not sure what quote you're talking about, but you could be referring to one of two different parts of the case. So, you know, first and foremost, and I think I said this earlier, the Supreme Court's decision, as we were talking about, doesn't get into whether or not Donald Trump engaged in insurrection. We have a decision here in Illinois from Judge Tracy Porter, where she very comprehensively evaluated evidence and reached a determination that Donald Trump did incite, support, failed to stop the January 6th insurrection, and by doing that, the January 6th attack on the Capitol, and by doing that, engaged in insurrection. That's a really important decision. In her role as a judge, she has done a public service by analyzing evidence and giving information to the people of Illinois and, you know, nationwide about what that evidence said. The same is true for the Colorado Trial Court, the Colorado Supreme Court, the Secretary of State of Maine. These are the only reviewing bodies that have actually analyzed evidence, and they've all unanimously reached the same result, that Donald Trump engaged in insurrection through his role in January 6th. So in that sense, the Supreme Court doesn't undo those factual determinations. They are important information for this country, in a climate where there's so much misinformation that's out there. In terms of our specific case, you know, there are some issues of Illinois law that are part of the case that we've been working on making sure are correctly decided. And so we're still in the process of analyzing exactly how that will work moving forward and the interplay between Judge Porter's decision on these Illinois law issues and the Supreme Court's decision.
All right. And finally, there's this matter of what I call metadata gate. I got to give you credit. I didn't know it was metadata until I actually did a little more deep dive. But this has to do with some detective work. Let's give the guy credit. A reporter for Slate whose name is Mark Joseph Stern. So shout out Mark Joseph Stern. He figured out that there had been originally there was going to be a dissent in this case by Justice Sotomayor, and that eventually that dissent, she joined the everybody, and it was like a concurrence. And so, like, this is in the weeds, Karen, if there ever is in the weeds. But the part of the story that intrigued me is not really, shouldn't be in the weeds, in my humble opinion. And that is the part of the story that deals with the internal wheeling and dealing and the politics of the justices to reach a decision. And they clearly wanted a 9-0 decision because they didn't want, I'm laughing as I say this, they didn't want to look as though they were biased against Donald John Trump, even though this ruling was very much biased for Donald John Trump. So let's just think about that, ladies and gentlemen. So they wanted to look as though this was a unified group of justices who are blind. And they're not taking anything else into consideration, even though what they're doing now totally contradicts what has, as we pointed out, been done for years and years and years. Okay. So in order to do that, they needed a 9-0 decision. And to get that 9-0 decision, there were some horse trades going on between the justices. This is what this article gets at in discussing why Sotomayor may have agreed not to write a dissent. So I know you've been studying all this stuff. I know, obviously, in your life, you probably talk about it with other lawyers. What's your sense of the interplay that happened behind the scenes between the justices to arrive at this decision?
I think that's a great question. I don't know. I mean, I know the conventional wisdom was that there were discussions between the justices about this case and the immunity case. I don't know whether or not that was true. You know, it seems clear that Justice Sotomayor, agreed to transition whatever was initially styled as a dissent into the concurrence, which I will say, if we're in the weeds, it is a pretty scathing concurrence. And, you know, whether or not it's called a concurrence or a dissent, maybe doesn't matter so much. But, you know, little tidbits that folks who don't pore over legal documents all the time may not pick up on. I mean, the concurrence opens, and this is a concurrence written by, you know, Justice Sotomayor, Justice Kagan, and Justice Jackson, who are, you know, commonly understood to be like the progressive justices of the court. And they start by talking about the Dobbs case and saying, you know, you all got it wrong. Let's quote Dobbs for that principle. And, you know, again, for folks who aren't in the weeds, Dobbs is the case that overturned Roe versus Wade. So for this particular group of progressive female justices to be saying, we're going to quote Dobbs at you, majority, to explain why you got this wrong, is a pretty biting technique of rhetoric. So, you know, they also later in the concurrence talk about Bush v. Gore. You know, there's a lot in here that, could straddle the line between a dissent and a concurrence quite easily.
Oh, I'm going to read you that line. Thank you for bringing that. I'd forgotten that. This is very important, even though it is in the weeds. And here's the exact line. Quote, it is not necessary to decide more to if it is not necessary to decide more to dispose of a case than it is necessary not to decide more. I didn't do a very good job of that. But essentially, that was a line from Dobbs. The warning embedded there is don't do anything other than what you have to absolutely do, because it's just going to be confusing and cause problems down the road, and make this case greater than it is. Make this decision greater than it is. And that's exactly what they did with, as you said, the stipulations that are both vague and specific, correct?
Right. And, you know, reading further, if we're going to start quoting from other cases, what they quote from Bush v. Gore, they say what it does today, the court should have left undone, which is a pretty strong rebuke. And, you know, I was reading some commentary about this and said, you know, it's going to be lost on a lot of people. But this is like these justices sounding the red alarm that the majority decision forecloses options about Section 3 of the 14th Amendment that it just truly should not have foreclosed. You got to get in the weeds to see that. But, you know, whether or not this is a dissent or a concurrence, it has some strong wording for Supreme Court decisions.
You know, I think they got double crossed. I think the progressives got double crossed. That's what this is saying. The deal was, we'll all go 9-0 on that. Colorado overstepped its bounds, and you can't boot Donald Trump from the ballot even for being an insurrectionist, even though he was an insurrectionist. And then they took it a step further with this gobbledygook about in the future, this is how you have to govern.
And I think the justices who are authoring the concurrences, including, you know, all four of them and the two separate concurrences, they're quite clear that they agree with the ultimate outcome. You know, and I'm sure that these differences were apparent from the outset, because, you know, most of those were forecast at the oral argument.
Yeah, it's a good point. All right. So we'll close with this. We've had many conversations on this show about this case before, obviously, the decision was rendered. Your colleague Ed Mullins was on the show. We had a delightful conversation. Mr. Ballot Access lawyer in the state of Illinois. And shout out, Ed. And pretty much everybody who came on the show, Karen, before the fact, in fact, pretty much absolutely everyone who came on the show before the fact said there is no way the Supremes are going to uphold Colorado. There's no way they got. Most people agree with what I said. They're either politically connected to MAGA, like Clarence Thomas, or they're just afraid. But there's no way they're going to allow Colorado or Illinois or Maine to remove Donald Trump from ballot. No way. You probably had you put your heart and soul into this. So you had more going on this than just casual observers talking on a political podcast. Did you in your heart of hearts believe that there was a chance you could prevail in this?
100%. You know, certainly, I mean, our legal team, including myself, you know, believed very, very strongly that our legal arguments were correct. We still believe that. And, you know, with all due respect to the Supreme Court, you know, I believe our team believes that Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is an enforceable part of the Constitution, and states should be and were intended to be able to enforce it. I did believe that there was a chance, maybe even a likelihood, that the Supreme Court would go that way. My belief was somewhat reduced after the oral arguments. You know, there were the questions that were asked at oral argument gave an indication of what they were thinking. But, you know, Noah Bookbinder, who is part of CREW, the organization that brought the Colorado case, made a really good point that I found very compelling, which is, you know, it is a very big deal to ask judges to hold that a popular candidate should not be on the ballot. They should ask hard questions. And so, you know, I was I was hopeful that that the decision would come out differently. I think it's notable that it doesn't touch the issue of whether or not Donald Trump engaged in insurrection. That's something that's quite meaningful to me. But, you know, I think there's a lot of us that really believed that this is not just not just the right thing to do, but really important to uphold the Constitution, uphold the rule of law, and do everything that was possible to protect democracy in this country, as you know, prescribed by the U.S. Constitution.
Well put. We'll close with this quote from Donald John Trump himself. Quote, this is in the aftermath of the ruling. I was very honored by the 9-0 vote. And this is for future presidents. This is not for me. That's one of the funnier things that Donald John Trump has said. And the guy does say some funny things from time to time. Do you have any thoughts on his quote?
I was much more interested when he called our legal team radical left lunatics, but, you know.
Did he really? I missed it. Did he himself call you? Ed Mullins? Oh, my God.
He called us that. And, you know, if that's what, you know, it means to try to work toward upholding the Constitution, then so be it. But, yeah, I mean, I don't believe for a minute that Donald Trump does anything to benefit you know, other political candidates beyond himself, future generations. I just don't.
Man, the whole thing was written to defend you, Trump. The whole thing was carefully concocted to keep you on the ballot. In fact, it's so carefully concocted to keep you on the ballot that what they kind of made rules for how to deal with this in the future. So it's, I don't know. We'll have to see how that plays out. Well, you know what? Karen, I hope we never have to deal with it again, because I hope we never face another insurrection. So I hope this is moot, if you follow what I'm saying, that there's only one Donald John Trump. Anyway, well, all right. Any closing thoughts you want to make before I let you go for the day? I know you got a busy schedule, so anything you want to add that you haven't added already, go ahead.
I just want to say thank you, Ben. I really appreciate, you know, your interest in this. Like I said, this has just been such a critical issue of folks around the country working to protect the Constitution and really protect democracy. And, you know, thank you for giving voice to that.
Oh, you're welcome. Well, remind everybody that this issue was to a large degree raised by a couple of law professors, one at the University of Chicago, conservatives. Okay, conservatives. This is a very anti-conservative decision, I would say. Where you're supposed to go by the letter of the law. Isn't that what they always say? You know, absolutely. We're like, language matters. And so in this case, language matters, except when it doesn't matter, Ben. And
yes.
I wish George Carlin were around for this. All right, Karen, thank you so much. Appreciate you coming on the show. Also want to thank producer Christy. Does an outstanding job. Peace and love, everybody.
And remember, you can catch up on previous Ben Jarofsky shows, Benny J bonus interviews, read columns from Ben Jarofsky, sign up for the Reader newsletter if you haven't yet, get great stories from great writers sent to your email every day, all at chicagoreader.com. And if you want to follow Ben on Instagram, that's easy, at Benny J Show. And don't forget to like, subscribe, and follow the Ben Jarofsky Show on your favorite streaming and podcasting platforms.